Hi, my name is Jamie Mackay and I head the Postgraduate Learning and Teaching Programmes at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. And this podcast is part of a series where I ask established arts educators about their practice. In this podcast, I'm very pleased to be talking to Shudebi Thakurata. Shudebi is a creative facilitator, transdisciplinary narrative designer, educator, writer, researcher, futurist, thinker and conversationalist with more than 17 years of experience across India, South and Southeast Asia, UK, Europe and USA. The co-founder of Transdisciplinary Design Collective, the Epicenter, Shudebi is an Associate Dean at Srishti Manipal Institute of Art, Design and Technology, one of India's premier pedagogy-led design institutes. Could you introduce yourself and say a little about your current role as an arts educator?
Yeah, so thank you for inviting me for this podcast. You know, it is one of the most difficult questions for me to answer when people ask me what exactly you do, because I have so many different interests, and I'm not one of those people who would like to be bounded by, say, job descriptions or titles that I have. So essentially, I would say that I'm a creative facilitator. I'm a transdisciplinary narrative designer. I'm a design educator and writer, researcher. But I think mostly I love being a conversationalist, because I feel that that is something that helps me connect to myself and to the world. In terms of what I do on a daily basis, I have two different hats that I wear. So I'm actually a design educator for the last nearly 13 years in one of India's oldest design school, Srishti Manipal Institute of Art, Design and Technology. I'm an associate dean there. And I teach across undergrad and postgrad. There is no specific courses that I teach, but I teach a range of different kinds of things. And I also, like as a part of being the associate dean there, I look after the creative education program in the undergrad BDES. And I also look after the postgraduate diploma program, which comes under our post-graduation program, you know. But at the same time, about 6 years ago, I started my own design-led innovation collective called The Epicenter. And I do a lot of experimental work where, I mean, although it is quite domain and discipline agnostic, I would say the kind of work that I do, even in The Epicenter. But there are a few things which I would say really make it a Depi Center kind of work. One is that I've noticed that the 55 plus projects that we have worked on in Depi Center in the last about 6 years globally, almost all projects had some kind of impact, whether it was social impact, cultural impact, educational impact, impact at the level of ecology, but there is an element of impact, however big or small. We also delve into storytelling, transdisciplinarity. We use design as an approach. We use art as a way to understand the world. We obviously delve into systems and, you know, complex systems thinking. But very important is that we look into everybody as a learner. Doesn't matter whether they are 60-year-old or 16, whether they are a CEO of a company or a leader in their own field. We consider everybody as a learner, and hence, you know, all the work that we do, we somewhere think about how different learners think differently, work differently, feel differently, act differently. So that is consciously included in the way in which we design things and narratives. And I would say that the other aspect of the work that really, really makes it my kind of work, if I would say, is I have noticed that in the beginning of my career, I was always interested in designing with fairness, designing with purpose, designing with dignity, you know, and things like that. But in the last many years, my work has shifted towards designing purpose and designing fairness and designing dignity, you know. So it's not about with that, but designing those things as, you know, as well. So that really binds all my work together. I'm not somebody who believes in boundaries. So I don't think that I have a personal life and a professional life. I have my Srishti life and my DFP Center life. They all feed into each other, and that nourish my soul as well. So that's about me.
Excellent. Thank you. So when you're working with learners, what's your goal?
I think I love playing with language, you know, and I know a few by virtue of being in India, but English is also a language that is very close to me. I mean, I understand its baggage and everything, but still I'm fond of English as a language. The reason why I'm saying this is that I always take words seriously and like to kind of play around with it. So when you ask me what is my role, what is my goal for learners, I would like to unpack the word learner itself. Who is a learner, you know? So I don't think of myself as somebody who's separate from the other learners. So I think it's a very interesting kind of a journey where we are co-travelers. So like students who I facilitate, or say if I work in so many different spaces where they may not be students per se, but I might be facilitating. And as I was mentioning you earlier, I consider everybody as a learner, including myself. So I feel like the goal is never really for the other. The goal is very much for myself as well. And I consider learning to be a very active thing. So it is not just about thinking. It's not about content which is being thrown at people. It's very much action, reflection, action. And learning is as much thinking and doing as much as it's feeling for me, you know, and seeing. So all of these things comprise learning. And I always think whether it's learners in terms of like students or anyone else I'm facilitating and myself, I'm a practitioner of collaboration, dialogue, co-creation. So along with the other learners, as co-travelers, we get influenced while we influence, right? So my goal is always to find out opportunities and possibilities to explore, to experiment, to experience. And it's a really, really two-way street. And I feel that that can happen through curiosity, a discovery, instilling in a sense of awe. And like I love saying the two words which are closely related to each other, wonder and wonder. So to actually travel and to be curious about, you know, to be wondering about what's happening, that's very important, because that really takes us out of our own boundaries. It tells us about the limitlessness of the possibilities that the world has to offer. And it stops us from getting caged into different boundaries that sometimes, you know, we create for ourselves. And I think that's my goal, to help people go beyond their own resistance, not to be stagnated, not get stuck to I want, I like, I dislike, but going beyond it. And also to sort of differentiate between fantasy and imagination, because I feel in the field of arts has the capacity or the capability to very seamlessly travel between the abstract and the concrete. But sometimes people, when they say this is what, like, you know, I'm imagining, what they're talking about is more like a fantasy. It's not rooted in reality, right? But the both are important, I feel. So sometimes you need to see the old with a set of new eyes. So for me, that's also another goal, because it allows you to understand your realities in different ways using different perspectives. And that sometimes offers a different kind of agency. I feel that, you know, learning requires agency. It requires ownership. It requires someone to actually say that, you know, I own it. I'm responsible. And I might make mistakes. And mistakes are such an important part of learning. You are bound to fail. But that failure is not about like feeling that, oh, it's a blunder. It's not. You know, you move on. You understand that, you know, that you need to be more playful about lives, you know. And I think that's also important as a goal. So this multiplicities of the possibilities that I feel I try to like open up for other people, in a way makes me somebody who help make other people, you know, make their own choices and find their own direction. So it is not about me giving direction, but find your own direction. And as I was mentioning, I always feel it's so important to be lost. If you can never find your way if you're not lost. So I feel like a big part of learning for me is also to have certain elements where you lose your path, because only then you find your own.
You've begun to answer probably a lot of the questions. I'm going to ask them anyway. You might you might refer back to what you've said, or you might come up with something new. But what barriers get in the way of achieving your goal then?
There are so many. And again, when I'm looking at it, I'm not just looking into, again, external learners, but including myself. But I would say that I like poetry. So I'll probably be a little poetic about it. So maybe I think one of the biggest barriers that I feel is in any kind of learning is people's perception of time and not understanding what time really means. And I'll tell you why, because I don't think we can really do anything without collaborating with others, right? We're constantly collaborating with others. And the moment you collaborate, one of the most important things is that you understand how each collaborator in a collaboration understands and deal with time. So for some people, you know, time is a very transactional thing. For some people, time is a very relational thing. And it can be culturally contextual. It can also be that, say, for some people, time, say, for example, you have the best intent to do a good piece of work and you're working with each other. One of the barriers happen in learning only where is that somebody is so deadline driven, and there's nothing right and wrong about it. It's just that for them, being able to finish something within the given deadline is most important. So one needs to understand why they're behaving that way. Whereas some people might want to take more time, you know, they are not particularly looking at time in terms of, oh, I need to finish something and be effective in that way within that given time. Maybe they're looking for quality in a certain way. So maybe something requires more time than how much is given. So it's important for people in that collaboration to understand each other. So it is not about calling each other responsible or irresponsible, thinking that some people are doing more or less. So anybody, I feel like this has been one of my biggest realizations in the last few years, that understanding time and the notion of time and how one relates to time, how one defines time is very important, and not understanding that becomes a big barrier in anything. The second barrier I would say is that trust and how, again, it's defined. You know, this is something that I've noticed, that for some people, having trust in something is that, you know, you can't question anything. You know, you have to like blindly believe something, that is known as trust. Whereas for some people, trust might be about the ability to be free, you know, to actually be respectful to each other, but the ability to ask questions, you know. So it's not about doubting, but the freedom to ask questions, you know. So that is trust. So again, if you don't have trust about each other, trust about the processes, trust about ourselves, that becomes a very big barrier in anything, I feel. So as I said, that one of the barriers is time and the perception of it. The second barrier is trust and how it is defined. The third barrier I feel often is validation and who it comes from. I feel most of us, knowingly or unknowingly, are looking for some validation. If it's not from external, we are looking for our own validation, you know, about something. And that limits us a lot of times. And what happens, therefore, is that rather than something that you get to see, that being inspirational for you, that rather than letting that inspire you, people try to imitate that, right? So you allow other factors, how others believe something to be successful, define how you measure success, how you look at success, how you think you've been able to achieve something. And this kind of a validation often, you know, becomes a barrier to learning, because you're not really doing something for the joy of it, for the learning of it, but you're looking for some kind of a validation. The fourth one I feel is structures and the misconception around it. And I feel this is something that I've seen happen time and again, Jemmy, that there is a misconception that freedom and structure are like enemies of each other. You know, like if you have structures in something, you don't have freedom. And especially in creative fields, in the world of art and design, people are always looking for freedom, right? That freedom is a very important element in the work. And it's almost like structures mean, the moment you talk about structures, people have this misconception that it means it's rules, it is limiting you? Actually, not really, because I feel that being a creative practitioner myself, in order to attain that kind of a freedom, you need certain structures. Now, where those structures are coming from and how do you define the structure can be something that one can explore. But it is not about not having any structures. You find your own structures, you know. Structures can be emergent in nature. And last but not the least, I would say in terms of barriers, I feel like the usage of this I and we often say, right? So when people say the word I, often I is not about the self, you know, like in terms of delving deeper into it, the I becomes a selfish, self-absorbed, obsessed kind of self, and that becomes problematic because then you're not thinking about the larger picture, right? But it's so important to have a sense of the self, to have your own individuality, your own uniqueness be intact. And the other kind of a misconception there becomes where we very often use the word we. So you're saying, okay, let's not talk about I, let's say we. But the we becomes not us, not breaking boundaries. The we is a way to sort of shed off responsibilities because, you know, like who's responsible sort of gets like lost. For example, when you say, oh, we are to blame. And when we say we are to blame for something, who is to be blamed, you know, when you're not saying who the we are. So I feel like we need to have like an expanded sense of self. We need to understand the I and the we better, be responsible, understand the self, but also connect it to the larger web of the world. So once these things happen, these have been my realizations, doors of learning open up because you start learning about yourself, you start learning about the world, you start learning with people with whom you work, you know.
Great, thank you. That's such a rich answer. Again, you touched on the next question, but that's absolutely fine. So, what strategies do you use to help you achieve your goal, and/or deal with the barriers?
I think I kind of connected to some of the things already, as you said. I would say, in short, making sense of experience is something which is very important. I feel like, you know, especially in a post-pandemic world, if you may call it that way, understanding experience is very important. How do you experience something? And there are so many ways to experience. And also that the same situation may not be experienced the same way by everybody present in that is important for people to understand. Because then this diversity or this plurality or the multiplicity of this experiential perspectives can really help us in going beyond our usual selves, you know. So I feel like as I was saying that, you know, if you look at it, when I said time and the perception of it often creates barriers. If we believe in experience, if the experiential learning actually enables you to understand time in a better way, trust has got a lot to do with, you know, again, experience as well, right? And I mean, many of the things that I spoke about. I think the other thing that I would talk about in it's not really a strategy, but it's a way in which I approach things. I give a lot of importance to imagination. You know, when you feel things around you going wrong, and it happens to all of us, it could happen even, say, for example, when I'm looking at everything as a barrier. What can help me when I may not even have data or like, you know, evidence or proof to sort of say that, well, the barriers will be gone anytime soon. I feel the belief in imagination and the practice of imagination, and I'm using my words very carefully, I feel can help somebody come up with a multitude of possibilities. And also very, very important is that not having formulas and templates for things, but the openness to find one's own path. You know, and working towards that I don't have to follow somebody else's path just because that has worked. Not saying you don't learn from others, but yeah, that can again be inspirational for me. But really, always focusing on finding one's own path is something very important because that does not then let you look for validation elsewhere. That allows you to find out your own structures and find your own freedom through that. And you know, like it kind of breaks boundaries of the self and the other.
So, how do you measure your success as an arts educator?
it's a kind of a difficult question because, you know, like measuring is always hard, right? So I think I'll tell you something which is kind of close to my heart. So at D Epicenter, my design studio, we do a lot of evaluation related work, you know, and we say that when we engage in different kinds of evaluation, how we do that is by using stories to capture achievements and present them in a kind of a result based form. So what we generally do is whoever we work with in evaluation, we help define a theory of change. And I'm not just talking about theory of change in a very like boring way, you know, like really a theory of change, which is very unique to every program that we are evaluating, where individual data collectively tell a story. And therefore, you know, our evaluation does not focus only on goals, but different stages in an overall program. And as we do that, what happens is a so-called failed outcome becomes a learning opportunity, because we are also attending to incremental progress, relative progress. And in that way, we are helping people to see process being successful, you know, even though the outcome may not be appearing to be successful. The reason I explain this is I think it's the same philosophy I have about understanding my own success or measuring it. For me, it doesn't have to be a big thing. I think I get the most joy, satisfaction, contentment when I say work in a space where it's almost like, and it has happened many, many times with me, that I have taken up projects or I have been given certain opportunities which to other people were not really opportunities. It's almost like setting yourself up for failure. People have said, why are you taking it up? You know it's not going to work. And there's nothing more satisfying than working in those spaces and seeing however tiny it is, you know, that sea change that can happen, the shifts that happen, the transformations that happen at a very human level. And that's why I feel like those successes are bigger successes for me, which ideally might be looking like not such big things, you know. But I feel like a so-called failed outcome then becomes a learning opportunity for me, you know, and that way it's successful because I'm actually learning. And only by capturing stories, I would say, stories of different kinds and being, the stories as I'm talking about allows me to be also perceptive to finding those stories, really become a way for me to understand whether it's successful or not.
Excellent. Thank you. The next two questions I'm pretty sure you have touched on, but we're going to ask them again just to clarify it. How would you describe the ideal relationship between you and your learner?
I think co-traveler. I would have one word, co-traveler, always. Co-traveler means we are co-exploring, co-experimenting, co-experiencing. You know, it's absolutely...
And you may think this, you have the same answer for the next question. So what job title are you most comfortable with?
It's funny because remember I started by saying I'm so not comfortable with titles. So I have two so-called job titles at the moment. I'm a faculty member and associate dean at Srishti. I am a co-founder, creative director at the Epicenter. But I think the way I like to define myself at this moment, and that can change, that should change, is, you know, how I describe myself on Instagram. So I have a few short phrases that I use for myself, and I would say that's my title, if you may call it. So I call myself an awestruck wanderer, a meta facilitator, a narrative designer, a learning curator, a dialogue weaver, possibility framer, and thinking visualizer. And I think that really covers who I am and my interests.
Excellent. Thank you. So what three values are central to your practice as an arts educator?
Yeah, I think I have different values and it's kind of hard to pinpoint any three, but if I may have to create kind of three categories of values, I would say one would be freedom and dignity. It's very, very important for me because I feel like freedom and dignity as value helping me being resilient and like practice that and hone that in spaces. The other kind of values that I believe in and that shape my work is well-being, care, kindness, empathy, that kind of values. And I feel like that really allows me to be having or practice endurance, which is again very important, resilience and endurance. And the last kind of category of values which are central to my practice would be fairness, openness, equity, trust, because I feel that only when somebody works with these values that you learn how to be patient. And I feel like there's no virtue as important as patience, you know, and you can only practice patience when you have the value of fairness and trust, because it allows you to be hopeful even when everything around you looks like they're going to fall apart and nothing is to be believed or trusted. But that's what allows you to be patient.
Okay, so let's ask a slightly different question now.
Yeah.
If you could have a mentor from any time in history, real or fictional, to support your arts education practice, who would you choose?
It's a difficult question, but I would say somebody I have always looked up to, not really as a mentor of that sort. I've never met him because he was dead many years before I was born. He is an Asian Indian poet, philosopher, polymath called Rabindranath Tagore or Rabindranath Tagore, and he was the first Nobel laureate. And the reason why I you may call him a mentor or whatever, for me, I think I have learned how to make sense of the world for many, many years as a child and even later on through his eyes. And when I'm saying, I'm not saying that he has made me biased through his lenses, but if you delve into Tagore, you would understand that he always offers many lenses all the time. He challenges himself all the time, you know. He questions different kinds of boundaries and boxes that sometimes define us. So I would have loved to have somebody like Rabindranath Tagore as my mentor. He also, you know, like just like a trivia, he started Shantiniketan around the same time when the Bauhaus movement was happening. And I was actually reading up, they're probably going to call his university, Vishwa Bharati, as a UNESCO heritage living university. Yeah, he started that because it's fascinating what he had tried to do. Of course, with time, there are things that happen which are not always so good, etc. But I think Tagore is so relevant even today, even in today's world. Sorry, couldn't hear you, Jimmy.
Sorry, I had a problem with my mute button there. So
no problem.
I'm fine. I'm back. So if you could ask him one question, what would it be?
Oh, I have been asking him questions all my life, you know. So as I was saying, that he was like a meaning-making mechanism for me as a child when I was growing up. And I used to have my own chats with him. So I keep asking him tons of questions. But just to be funny, maybe I would ask him, why is he not here now? Why isn't he there? Why isn't there another Tagore now?
So how do you think he would answer?
I would imagine him saying that, I want you to find your own path. You don't need me physically, because that's what he stands for. He wants people to find their own answer and find their own path. So I'm sure he would say, don't copy me. Don't look for an answer from me. Ask more questions and find your own path.
Excellent. Thank you. So final question, is there anything else you'd like to say about your arts education practice?
I would say that, you know, it's very important to not fall into the narratives that sometimes become popular around you. It's very important to find your own narrative, construct your own narrative. And finding your own narrative often requires you to deconstruct, sometimes demolish your own narrative as well. Because otherwise, you know, like arts really allow you to be flexible, to be fluid, to be adaptive, to be emergent, right? So if we try and get stuck to this one narrative that that makes us who we are, then that's the end of arts, that's the end of education, and that's the end of practice. So I really feel it's very important to constantly reinvent, rediscover yourself. And imagination is key. Without imagination, there is really nothing, I believe. So it's very important to constantly foster your imagination.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with this, such a rich range of responses, and there's so much there for our listeners to take away. So thank you so much for joining us today, Debbie. I've really enjoyed
the
chat.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the chat, absolutely. And the questions are very interesting. Difficult sometimes because, especially somebody like me, I don't like responding in very definitive way always, because there is always a danger of people just putting it in a bite-sized thing and then this is what it is. So yeah, I think the questions were provocative.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. For more podcasts in this series, go to portal.rcs.ac.uk/arts-educator-interviews.